Hello and welcome to Living Downstream. I'm Julie Lowe, the Environmental and Education Outreach Leader through United Communities AmeriCorps and one of the hosts of Living Downstream. Our topic today is invasive species, and I'd like to welcome Samuel Chan, an invasive species expert out of Oregon State. Sam is an associate professor in fisheries and wildlife at OSU. He serves as a Sea Grant Extension statewide aquatic invasive species and watershed health specialist, and is a current vice chair of the Oregon Invasive Species Council. Sam's work focuses on understanding the roles of human activities on invasive species pathways. Welcome to Living Downstream, Sam, and thank you for your time. Can you tell us more about yourself?
Happy to be with you, and thanks for the invitation. Yeah, so I actually grew up in San Francisco's Chinatown, and in a place that was virtually devoid of green space and trees. But every day I would actually see trucks bring in loads of vegetables and fruits and plants and fish and meats. And I've always wondered, where did that always come from? And so that led me a career into what I'm doing now, is really understanding our natural resources and our food supplies and how people impact them and or can better them. And so that's where I came to be. And I started working actually initially for the U.S. Forest Service as a research scientist, and I decided that I wanted to spend more time working with the public and working with students, and so I joined Oregon State University and now serve as its Sea Grant Extension statewide watershed health and invasive species specialist. Thanks.
Fantastic. I love this topic. I'm from Montana, but I've been living on the East Coast for 30 years, and invasive species is not a huge issue because it seems everything out there is invasive. Like we don't even know what's our native species out there anymore. So coming out to Oregon, I see a lot more awareness of the issue, and I'm kind of loving that. Just to start off for the layman, which is kind of me, can you tell us about what an invasive species is and how it compares in general to a non-native species? How is it different or the same as a non-native species?
Well, the thing is that our society, human society, has relied on non-native species and native species for subsistence and shelter since mankind evolved. And so when you look around what's really sustained us, much of our food base actually is from plants and animals and fibers that are not native to this region. However, about anywhere from about 3 to maybe 8% of all introduced species become invasive. And so what is invasive? Invasive is a non-native plant, organism, animal, microorganism that actually does ecologic harm, environmental harm, and human health harm. And it could be all three of those, or it could be one of those. And it's a plant that, it's an organism that gets established, and we have great difficulty in controlling it because most of these invasive organisms ended up being wonderful, and I shouldn't say wonderful engineers, but they actually engineer the environment to the point where they become very difficult to control. They become dominant.
So invasive is not necessarily synonymous with non-native. Like there could be something that's non-native that is not necessarily invasive. Is that
right?
Accurate?
That's very accurate, because when you look around what really people and society have subsisted on is many of the organisms that we have or that we use are non-native.
I would think like wheat, maybe in corn. Isn't
wheat,
corn first?
Right.
Yeah.
And then people used to trade items from early millennia on. And so that's how we actually ended up having things that we normally don't have. They're out of season, and we would trade for them and store them and preserve them.
And I think you kind of answered this, but let's hit it home a little bit more. What is then the traits or the characteristics that make a species invasive?
An invasive species is an organism that's easily adaptable to a range of habitats and environments. And another aspect about them is that not just do they adapt to that environment, but they alter that environment to favor themselves.
And to the detriment, I guess, obviously, to the local species.
Often, very often.
Yeah, it takes up maybe their space and their food and whatnot. I've also heard the term non-indigenous species. Is that another way to say non-native or invasive, or is it what's the difference between a non-indigenous and a non-native and an invasive? Is that just a more polite way of saying it?
Yeah, that is, a lot of that is semantics, but when we think about indigenous, we're thinking about what was originally here based upon what on rather it recorded human time, and record does not mean from writing, could mean verbal or pictorial through time. And so what is considered indigenous is really from a human perspective. And also what is native and non-native, the thing is that the world has evolved, and some species have kind of migrated in terms of their ranges. For example, if climate becomes cooler or warmer, some species are able to expand their range. So what was native now may not have been native back maybe even just 100 years ago. But those cases are relatively small compared to the main way that invasive species arrive in our ecosystem, and that's through human introductions.
What is the most significant challenges in dealing with invasive species?
I think the most difficult challenge is that invasive species are associated with people. People like certain characteristics of these invasive species. Some of them are very beautiful. They produce beautiful flowers. Some of them produce beautiful edible items. Some of them are brought over because of transportation. And for example, when you think about, you know, horses and wild Mustangs, we brought them over here because they were here. They were essentially our human tractors right before fossil fuels came about. And when they were replaced by machinery and powered equipment, we no longer needed as many horses, and they were released, and then they became feral, for example.
Right. I had heard a talk the other day, in fact, on the wild horses of Oregon, and there was some argument about whether they're an invasive or a native species.
Yes.
What are they now? And that, I guess I'm going to address that later, but, you know, when does a species become native, if that's even possible? When does it become, I guess, naturalized?
Right. Yeah. I think for us who work in the field, it's difficult for us to use the word naturalized. I mean, we can say that they're abundant in the landscape, they're dominant in the landscape, but we often don't apply the term naturalized frequently in our work, because these organisms have altered that environment so that they can become dominant, or maybe that's the word you use, naturalized.
And in researching this interview, I ran into all these words, and I want to be politically sensitive to the correct way to say things. And I just don't know. I'm learning as I go along. So that's helpful. What are some methods or tools used for controlling and managing invasive species in natural systems once they're here?
Yeah, well, obviously the best tool is prevention, and being able to understand what species have characteristics that are invasive and not bring them here in the first place. But that's not always the case, mainly because through human activities, we bring a lot of organisms over inadvertently and advertently. And once they're here, then we need to be cautious about how we actually move them and spread them. And when they do escape and become invasive and aggressive and then invasive and establish and reproduce through multi-generations, we have to think of different controls on them so that they do not end up taking up all the resources, whether it's water, nutrients, food, space, over plants we desired. And in that case, we actually have to use mechanical means, pulling, tilling, killing. And I hate to use the word killing, but that's happened.
I do too, right.
Non-native animals sometimes. And we have to use chemicals. We use biological control at points, but the key is to prevent these species from spreading further, so that, you know, where they have invaded, we can contain where their invasion is and still be able to grow and have the environments that we value ecologically, you know, for the environment and also for people.
I know recently coming from the East Coast, the lantern flies are a big deal right now. Everybody's up in arms about that, and we're to kill it on site, and it's a beautiful little bug. So it's strange.
Certainly is a very emerging invasive species here in Oregon because of their impacts to our forests. They become so abundant that the trees just can't photosynthesize or to be able to convert that solar energy into leaves and wood and fiber and nutrients. And so it's a very important species that we want to keep out. But spotted lanternflies also have a host. And so some of these hosts are actually invasive plants and trees. Yeah.
So the host is invasive as well.
The host is invasive. And so remember, these invasive species don't come from necessarily this ecoregion. They come from another ecoregion. And so we have a plant or animal that is from that under that same ecoregion. It could very well be the host. And that seems to be the case for the spotted lantern.
So the spotted lanternfly has reached Oregon?
It hasn't reached Oregon yet.
Okay.
And we prefer it not to. That's where being aware of it and having many eyes amongst our citizens is very helpful, because if we see populations in low abundance, there's a greater chance that we can actually prevent that population from establishing and reproducing.
I say I just moved. And so that makes me want to go through our luggage and our boxes and see if I had any castaways come along with me.
Yeah, the good thing is that when it comes to names, the spotted lanternfly, it's a good common name, because you think about it, it's got three words in it, right? Spotted, lantern shape, and a fly. So therefore, it's easier for the public to see that. Whereas if we called it the Chinese fly or the European fly, how do you know if it's actually Chinese or European, for example, right? The spotted fly does help the public.
It's very distinctive looking. How do non-Indigenous species spread then? Once they got here, for instance, I have some stick bugs here from Australia, and I know if they got loose, they'll die in the winter.
Right.
So I'm pretty sure those won't become a problem, but they'll die. So those are pretty containable if I'm very careful. What about other ones? Are some species just, like you said, one thing about invasive species is they're such engineers. So how do they spread so successfully?
Well, they spread through, there are two mechanisms for success. One mechanism is that we move them around as hitchhikers. For example, there could be eggs, there could be organisms. Let's say with some of the invasive fruit flies, for example, we ended up, you might have an apple tree and it produces delicious apples. But as you all know, apples tend to attract a lot of insects. And we share them. Say Thanksgiving time, it's a time where we say, oh wow, we go out there and the family is gathering and we see apples in the trees, and the relatives could be coming, they say, from northern Washington up there in Bellingham, or they could be coming from California, and they see these apples and we pick them and don't think that they're actually fruit flies or moths that are actually in that apple, and we move them. So that's one way. The other way is through dispersal. Some plants are like, there's a iris that produces a beautiful yellow flower, but however, it's called the yellow flag iris. This plant ends up creating islands in moving water where there should be moving water, and you end up with islands of plants, and then these islands trap silt, and so you no longer have moving water, but you end up having a meadow. And so this plant actually has several ways of moving around. It moves around because its seeds mature. They're ejected as a capsule. The seeds look like round corks. So they're ejected and they float in the water. They also have underground stems called rhizomes that break off with floods that then can establish further downstream. So these plants are pretty adaptable in the way that they're able to move around. Also, another way is, think about when we go hiking. Sometimes we end up hiking into the woods or through fields. And when we come back, what are all these seeds that are stuck on our clothes? That's another way of moving them. Another way is that it's through recreation. We might have an aquarium, let's say a snail that we no longer want, or even that goldfish that we no longer want. We end up releasing it and we don't realize that goldfish are very adaptable and they're not native here. Goldfish actually are a carp. And so they'll eat out anything. So there are different ways that we end up moving, and a lot of it is inadvertent in terms of how we move them unknowingly.
It's kind of interesting. It almost sounds like invasive species are kind of a superpower animal.
Yeah, because they've adapted to human behavior, essentially.
As opposed to our spotted owl or whatnot, that, you know, where's his superpowers? Yeah. Why weren't they as successful in their own region as an invasive coming in?
Right.
And I guess, I mean, I understand they evolved together with the plants here.
Mm-hmm.
So they're successful with who they were supposed to be with.
Right. And when you lose some of that habitat, obviously the owl was less successful in feeding and reproducing, and therefore its long-term success becomes more threatened.
But it's kind of funny, the invasive species did not evolve here, yet they're super successful, whichever one we're talking about. For the introduction of invasive species, who's most responsible? Is it humans? Is it other animals?
Well, unfortunately, it is humans, but I have to qualify that in that many of the plants and animals and organisms we introduce do not become invasive. They don't have all these engineering characteristics, all these reproductive characteristics that make them invasive. However, humans are the main source of bringing in organisms, and therefore there's a certain percentage, as I mentioned earlier, about 3 to 8% that end up becoming invasive.
How about animals? Are there any other animals that bring in other invasive animals?
That can happen. Certain organisms can carry a disease, a parasite with them. And a good example is that in Oregon, we really only have one native crayfish. That's the American signal crayfish. And you see that because right between their claws, there's a white spot on them. So when they open them, it's like a signal, right? Because compared to their red brownish body, there's this white spot on their claws. And so this species was actually introduced into Europe as a source of food. And so the crayfish itself may not have been that damaging, but however, it also carried a fungus. And that fungus has decimated European crayfish populations. Very few native European crayfish left because we introduced the American crayfish into Europe.
Ah, that's interesting.
So it goes both ways, right?
Yeah. You know what? I just heard about that crayfish the other day because I understand it's an Oregon native. However, it's not native, not supposed to be in Crater Lake. And some folks were up in arms because it is now in Crater Lake. So how can you explain that to me? He's a native crayfish, but not in Crater Lake. But does he deserve to be there? Is it wrong for him to be there? Or, how do you know?
Yeah,
when does something become invasive?
Oregon Public Broadcasting, actually, I believe it was the Oregon Field Guide some years ago, created a really good documentary about these non-native crayfish, which is the American signal crayfish, in Crater Lake. And so when we think about invasive species, or think, oh, it has to come from another continent, that's right. Not the case. It actually could be coming from the next mountain range over, in that the mountains actually provided a barrier crayfish. So Crater Lake never actually had crayfish until, unfortunately, somebody released that crayfish into it.
It could have been as easy as some kid who caught it, the next valley over. And then on their way home, the parents said, "You can't take that home."
Right.
So yeah, he just dropped it in the lake on his way
can
through.
Can you imagine an American signal crayfish crawling 7,000 feet over a pass?
Right.
That's not very likely.
Now, specifically talking to that crayfish, what's the problem with him being in Crater Lake? Like, what specifically is he hurting, or who is he particularly hurting, or whose resources is he taking in Crater Lake?
Well, one thing is that Crater Lake, it's a very, very deep lake. These crayfish actually create burrows. So they erode the sides of the lakes.
Oh,
they create very deep tunnels and burrows where they actually use those to actually escape from to weather the harsh climate environment. So that's one thing. The other thing is that in Crater Lake, they're one of the top aquatic predators, along with some of the, now fish wasn't native in there either. That was introduced.
Oh. which fish are in there?
There are some, I believe there, I correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that long time ago, there was some trout that was introduced in the Crater Lake. That was well before we knew better.
Right, right. Well, I know there's brookie trout all over, and they're supposed to be an East Coast
fish. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So, crayfish being their omnivores, they consume both plants and animals. And so you've got suddenly a new organism in that water body that consumes everything from amphibians to insects to plants that shouldn't have been in there.
Okay,
so it changes the food chain, the food web, and the food dynamics. And plus, they like to burrow.
Right. And I think that would be particularly hard on the amphibians.
Yes, it would be.
What about, let's talk about some other favorite invasive species of Oregon. I was terribly hurt when I came here and found out that the turkey is not native, because I love my turkeys. I came here, they are native out east, and you never saw one. And out here, I have a whole flock, and I'm delighted with them, but I'm told I shouldn't be, and I'm told I will get sick of them. But right now, I think they're delightful. But tell me about the turkey. He's not supposed to be here either, right?
Right, the turkey, pheasants, quails—you know—it's all relative. They were introduced as part of the game aspect of, you know, for hunting,
right?
But they are not native here, and so based on their feeding habits, their ability to scratch and expose soil and ground, they actually can do quite a bit of damage locally, especially if you have a garden, for example. They can do quite a bit of damage to your garden, you know. But of course, these are human values. And in the native world, that's a species that's also competing with other birds as well. And so.
Right. And I love my fence lizards. Love my fence lizards. And I know they eat them because they're omnivores too.
Right.
And they eat my frogs. I love my frogs.
Yes.
So that is my problem with the turkeys.
But other than the introduced and, you know, the invasive bullfrog, is not from another continent. It's actually from the east. It's actually from the east side of the U.S. and the Midwest. They, I wish they would eat the bullfrogs, but they did.
Bullfrogs are probably as big as they are.
Yes,
I've run into the bullfrog tadpoles out here, and I'm allowed to collect them because they are invasive. So that's I do is whenever I find them, they come inside the house into the aquarium with me. How about the blackberry? I love the blackberry as well. The non-native blackberry.
Yes, the Armenian blackberry, a delicious invasive species at certain times of the year. But the reality is that once a blackberry occupies a piece of land or ground or habitat, it doesn't let go. So you actually end up with monocultures of this blackberry, which is not native to this country. It's a hybrid that essentially escaped, and it's got great dispersal mechanism. People love to eat them.
Right.
Bears and other animals eat them. Birds eat them, and then they end up dispersing. And so we actually have a lot of blackberries. Unfortunately, one of the few effective ways to control blackberries is by chemical means, herbicide means. And so, you know, our options for controlling blackberries is very limited. If you mow them, you're spreading, you're encouraging the sprout.
Right. You're just doing worse. Yeah.
Yeah. If you try to dig out the roots, but you just leave a few of those rhizomes in the ground, you end up with a more vigorous plant. So it's very hard to dig blackberries too.
Those are plants I like as well out here, and my stick insects eat those. So it works for me, but you're right. They're taking over. How about, do we have snapping turtles out here yet? I know that's a problem.
They've been released as pets, as pet releases.
I guess along with red ear sliders. Yeah.
Very many of those.
And those are the most popular pet store turtle.
Yes. And the thing is that when they're small and in your aquarium, as children love them as pets. Unfortunately, they end up being quite large, and as often sometimes with pets, children lose interest with them, especially, you know, not the furry ones. They end up having to, you have to do something with it. And I wish we actually had a pet amnesty program where people can bring them into pet stores and or bring them into Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And you know, eventually they'll probably end up being euthanized. But these turtles are certainly harming our native turtles and other amphibians. But it's very challenging when what used to be your pet, it's not something that is easy for people to, you know, think about the fact that, well, they'll do more harm by releasing than by euthanizing them when they're no longer your pets.
Right. And the problem with that turtle in particular, it's a pretty dirty turtle, or at least all turtles are actually when they get bigger, and it's hard to keep the cage clean. So I can imagine the kid doesn't want to, and the parents are over it as well.
Yeah, that's a problem with schools. In schools, pets are an important part of students learning how to care for, and it provides a calming effect, and it gives students a sense of responsibility, ownership, and also learning about just the behavior and biology of pets. But the problem is, during the school breaks and at the end of the school year? What do you do with all those classroom animals?
Right. And the next class doesn't necessarily want that animal. They want their own animal for
Maybe
their pet.
not, yes. And
Right.
do you
Right.
let the student bring it home? And if they bring it home, then at some point, the student might be tired of it. And then what do you do? You end up
Right.
releasing.
Another problem we have out east is the snakehead fish. Now, that's apparently a fish that can walk from lake to lake at nighttime, I guess. It could stay out of the water for a bit and move from pond to pond. But then I had another expert tell me that it's not as bad as it sounds, because the snakehead, and he says it breeds like 5 times a year. So one thing it does is it keeps producing small fish that can be used as food for our native herons or other native animals there. So my friend was saying it's not all bad, because it's invasive, yes, but it's also a food source, a constant food source for our natives. Do you find that to be a good argument ever? Fish produces so often that it's a constant food source.
Some of our native animals and birds and animals and fish actually have adapted to consume some of these invasive organisms. It's certainly not their favorite organisms. The thing is that if the snakehead wasn't there, then we would actually have native fish that would be for these native birds to be consuming. So that's the trade-off. Our native animals are pretty adaptive. They'll use what they can, but it's not necessarily the best nutrition source for them.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah, it wouldn't necessarily be. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
And
how
the
about...
snakehead, mainly because of the way it looks, it's become an icon for an invasive species. You're right.
And I understand it's delicious. You could sell them back to restaurants and whatnot, and I guess it's a fun fish for anglers. So our anglers out there kind of like it. They've gotten used to it, and they kind of like them because it's a fun fish to go after.
Lionfish is another one like that too. That was
the lionfish.
Aquariums. Yes.
Yeah. Is invasive species a bigger problem in the coastal areas than it is would be like in interior Oregon?
Actually, if you look at the investments that that people, whether it's farmers or parks or land management agencies, have invested into controlling invasive species or looking at the economic impacts, most of these species tend to be more inland species, less so marine. And it's not because the marine invasives are not critical, but they are very damaging. The problem is that the ocean is so large, it's dilutive, and therefore any management we do needs to be done in such a large scale that we don't necessarily have the financial resources, or certainly don't want to put that amount of control agents, whether it's chemicals or other means, into a large body of water because it's not contained. Yeah, so marine invasive species are certainly very harmful, but our ability to control them is low at this point. And in Oregon, we're dealing with the invasive green crabs, which are very strong predator of our native crabs, like the red rock crabs and the Dungeness crabs and the native shore crabs. However, they're very difficult to control, and they drift with the currents.
Where are they coming from?
They were initially brought over when we during the 1800s, when we were actually bringing over materials packed with seaweed and other items, whether it was seafood or maybe even oysters, when we were bringing them to culture here in the U.S. And in the process, they hitchhiked along with those materials when we were importing items from Europe. And also because, like most shellfish, they actually have a planktonic form, a microscopic form that swim when they're young. They came in the ballast water of ships as well, because ships need ballast to maintain their stability in the water. And let's say you're from the Rhine River. You have a ship that came in and it took in ballast water from the Rhine River. And when it arrived in New York, it would discharge that water because you didn't need that ballast. And
right.
Then you would actually then take in ballast water from New York and you end up bringing it back to Germany.
I got it.
That's
All right.
Another means of spreading invasive species. So that's how the green crab came about on both sides, in the East Coast and the West Coast. And right now, that is probably one of our major marine invasive species, the green crab, because of what it's doing to our native crabs and fisheries and the habitats that our native crabs and fish rely on, like with the eelgrass, for example.
Right. Huh. Okay. For our guests just tuning in, let me remind everybody this is Living Downstream on 99.7 KQUA. I'm your host, Julie Lowe, and we're speaking with invasive species expert Samuel Chan. So, Samuel, when we were driving out to the West Coast, once we started getting into the West a little bit, we started seeing all those signs saying if you're pulling a trailer or a boat, you need to pull over and I guess wash off your boat. Is that I had never seen those signs before, and I've lived out in the West all my young life. So is that a new strategy, washing off the boats as they go between states and whatnot?
Me and that strategy has come about because the West, and specifically here in Oregon, in the West, Oregon and Washington, we're one of the few states that do not have the invasive zebra and quagga mussels.
Oh,
And
so that's what it's for.
and the zebra and quagga mussels have invaded vast parts. They've invaded all the Great Lakes and have caused hundreds of millions of dollars in damage to infrastructure, to ecology, to recreation. And that's a species that right now is not in Oregon and Washington, and it's not in well established in many of our Western states. So many of our Western states have these boat inspection programs because these zebra quagga mussels, adults can attach to boats and live for weeks out of
And
water.
out of the water.
And so if you move a boat from, say, Lake Michigan,
Right.
and then you end up planting it into Lake Billy Chinook here in or in eastern Oregon, you can actually end up spreading the zebra or quagga mussel into Oregon, and the impacts to Oregon, the zebra or quagga mussels, are huge. When you think about Oregon, what's the iconic thing that people think about? It's green, it's beautiful, and the water.
Yeah.
And we have so many water resources that the zebra and quagga mussels will end up invading and impacting.
Be devastating. Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't realize those signs were specifically for that. So when we talk to people about invasive species, it seems to me that money talks. So what are the economic issues with invasive species, if we can turn put it in terms of money?
Okay, well,
Like, how is economics responsible?
it is huge. Worldwide, invasive species cause well over $1 trillion a year in damage. That's worldwide.
Right.
Here in the United States, we're in the hundreds of billions of impact from invasive species. And when we're talking about impact, we're not just talking about competition and reduction in the yield of crops. We're not just talking about competing weeds in garden or the effects of invasive insects and what they do to plants and animals that we like. It's also about changes in recreation. For example, areas that are heavily invaded are areas that people usually don't like to recreate in, because
Right.
that's just, and so you lose some of that recreation value. And then economically, for example, in Southwest Oregon, where the Umpqua River drainage eventually empties out into, we have a disease here called sudden oak death, which is impacting all the native oaks, but it also impacts other species. And it turns out that sudden oak death was associated with our timber that we export. Other countries will not want that wood. So, for example,
Oh, so we lose sales.
we lose sales like Coos Bay. There's about 1,200, I believe there's about almost 1,200 jobs related to wood export, just Coos Bay alone. And so you can imagine that if a fraction of the timber we export from those are no longer allowed, say by European or Asian nations, let's say even just 15%, you can imagine the tens of millions of lost revenues that can have on the economy. So that's really important. If, say, the that quagga zebra mussel actually arrived in Oregon, it would. We're so reliant on dams and water transport that they would actually foul the pumps and the cooling systems, you know, water transport systems. And here in Oregon, so not just would they impact the ecology, but also the economy. And one aspect most people don't think about when it comes to water systems, along with our dams that these zebra quagga mussels can impact, is Oregon is now one of the major data centers for, you know, for our data use. So whether it's Google or AWS, Amazon, Microsoft, all of these companies have major server farms in Oregon, and they locate here for two reasons. Three reasons. One is that we have abundance of relatively cheap water that they can use for cooling. We have an abundance of electricity that's relatively low compared to the U.S. And also, when you think about Central Oregon, Eastern Oregon, and the Columbia River, is relatively safe from terrorist threats. Because of their locations. And so, but if, because these systems are so reliant on water, you can imagine if we ended up with a quagga zebra mussel infestation in the state, that even something that we wouldn't think of, that's not food or environment related, but it's data related, like server farm, could be impacted by these zebra quagga mussels.
Yeah, long reaching effects that you don't think about.
Right. And each one of these plants costs $1 billion to build.
Yeah, yeah. But this is basic bottom line, people's jobs lost. Yeah, it hits home very, very quickly. And folks don't necessarily see that when you're a little bit sloppy in when you're caring for these things.
Right. And then to control something like an infestation like Idaho, like Colorado, Idaho, they spent hundreds of million dollars just to try to control an infestation of a zebra quagga mussels. It's not cheap to do
that. Colorado, you said.
Yeah. And we don't, where's Oregon going to get their resources to control something like that? That's a challenge.
Yeah.
Especially
Colorado sounds very close.
It does.
Mm-hmm. It's just the state or two over.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about the concept of existence value of invasive species? I hear that's a controversial topic, like the value of a species just exists. Are you familiar with that term?
Yeah, I think that's a social topic that we think about. That the reality is that organisms did not form or evolve in our world to be
right.
Okay.
Right.
Where they are in their native environment, they have natural predators and controls and environments that keep them in check. But however, due to mostly human activities, we've moved these organisms away from their checks and balances. And so in those cases, then you have to relative benefit is that, do you end up favoring a invasive species that is harming our native species? And so that's a balance that, you know, we as a society need to make. And I think most people would say that we realize that it's unfortunate that the organism was released here, it became established, having these impacts. But most people would probably choose the native organism over the one that is invading.
What about the argument about biodiversity and complexity? That if I add more and more species to your environment, everything is going to have to up its game.
Yeah.
And become better competitors and more creative and more, in the end, stronger, because they have to fight it out.
Survival of the fittest.
Yeah. Does that argument have any merit?
Actually, with invasive species, most of the time it doesn't have merit, mainly because invasive species simplify a system. They like being the dominant organism. And so you lose that biodiversity when you have an invaded environment.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I think so about the bullfrog.
Imagine bullfrog or vast fields of blackberries, right? How many What species grow within a blackberry thicket?
Right. We bought 16 acres out here, and the bottom half is blackberry, and
Oh dear.
the top half is nice. But you're right, it's like going into two different worlds.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so invasive species, where they invade, usually reduces biodiversity.
Then another argument I hear is when invasive species or other species come in, it helps our opportunity to develop an ecological understanding of how species evolve and work together. Because now throwing in this invasive, it's making again everybody work harder to survive. And that helps us understand how species evolve and compete. No
Well,
merit with that one either, right?
yeah, in a resilient system where we actually have a high biodiversity, and that's what a lot of our restoration efforts are. There's a lot of time and money and energy invested into restoring the health of our ecosystem, right? Making them more resilient. And those healthy ecosystems, the ones that have more diversity, the ones that are able to tolerate our changing climate, fires and droughts and flooding and freeze, cold temperatures, those systems are actually a lot more able to tolerate the changes in the environment versus when you have one invasive species, you actually have less tolerance because that invasive species stresses the other organisms in that environment, especially the native ones. So in the long run, having invasive species doesn't necessarily increase the fitness of native species, but it might actually reduce their genetic diversity because there's less of our native species out there, for
Yeah,
example.
cut half of them out. So
Yeah, you cut half them out.
drop the gene pool in half. Right. Well, you had mentioned climate change and environmental factors. Do those influence the spread of invasive species?
Yes, very much so. You think about going back to what's a characteristic of invasive species. It's a
Right.
species that has broad environmental tolerance and it's able to reproduce through different mechanisms, for example. And climate change is almost a perfect environment that sets up that favors an invasive species with those characteristics over our native species. Now, native species, if we actually have that a diversity of species or that complexity or biodiversity, both in the gene pool and also in terms of the species, they're able to probably adapt to climate change very well. But when you have a simplified system and further pressured by an invasive species competition and climate change, then the native species really lose out.
Are there any success stories that you can relate of dealing with invasive species? Do you have any personal stories or a good success story that you've experienced?
Oh, in terms of being able to eradicate an invasive species?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say that in Southern California, there's a lagoon that was invaded by an invasive algae. After about 4 years and almost $5 million, they were able
Jeez.
to eradicate that algae. Not that's a lot of costs
Right.
in revenues, right? But most of the time when it comes to eradicating an invasive species, we actually have had some success. For example, there is a moth, I think it's called the spongy moth from Asia. So it's like it used to be called the gypsy moth, but gypsy moth is not a good term to use because it's degrading to a certain group or culture of people in Europe.
Oh,
And so
okay.
now it's called the spongy moth because it makes more sense because the spongy moth is named that way because it lays these eggs that looks like a sponge. So that makes sense. The key thing is that it was discovered that these spongy moths from Asia were actually laying their eggs in a superstructure of ships that were coming across the Pacific, say from Korea and Japan. And if they actually got established in Oregon, we would actually have a lot of defoliation in our landscape, in our urban trees, as well as our natural forests as well. And so what happened was is that U.S. Customs and Border Protection learned of a way to really inspect these ships before as they came in, even before they actually docked when they were out in the ocean. And okay. So those ships that actually had these egg masses, they either had to clean off the egg masses throughout all the nooks and crannies on these ships, or else they would turn around. And so therefore, ship captains and shipping companies really took that to heart. And the last thing you want to do is to turn a huge cargo ship around, because
right.
that's a lot of lost time and revenue.
Yeah.
So the shipping companies are looking at these ships and trying to clean them before they come. And then when they come in the U.S. territorial waters, they get inspected. And so that's been success. One success is oftentimes when we actually do see a spongy moth outbreak, they're usually small in Oregon. And so agencies, local agencies like in the Umpqua or up in the Columbia River system, they actually work with the neighborhood because people are afraid and often scared and skeptical about pesticides. But right. But people understood that the impacts of this moth in their neighborhood, can you imagine defoliating a majority of the trees in your neighborhood? They understood that value. And then, but it was really more about ensuring would it be safe with this pesticide? And this pesticide for controlling the spongy moth is made from a form of a bacteria. It's an agent from a bacteria. So it's a biological organic pesticide. And so it's very specific to caterpillars. Mm-hmm. And so the neighborhood actually had buy-in. And because of that, a infestation of the spongy moth was actually eradicated in different parts of the state, including Portland and other parts of the state. So those are some of the successes. So we don't actually have active spongy moth infestations in the state. And when we do, they're usually detected early, hopefully, and they're controlled before they spread and do a whole lot of harm.
Yeah, and the way you were telling the story, it almost sounds like you were saying individuals had a part to play in it.
Oh, it is.
Like it wasn't corporations or agencies. It was people, individuals.
Right. Well, the agencies helped.
Well, I was going to ask, though, can an individual contribute enough to make a difference?
Individuals can make a huge difference in contributing to preventing invasive species. One is just to be aware of what we do when we go hiking and camping, is make sure we clean our gear. If we put a bolt in a water body, make sure that we clean it before we actually put that into another water body. Clean your clothes, clean the gear that you use, like the shovels in your garden. When you're sharing a plant with someone, sees a beautiful plant in your garden and they want that. And so you instead of digging it up with all the soil attached, you actually may consider washing off that soil and inspecting it. So that'll reduce the chance of you spreading an organism to your friend. Because as much as your friend loves that plant, I don't think they come with it.
Right. Now, when you say clean your clothes and clean your shovels and whatnot, let's get real specific. Like, is this, how do you do that? Spraying off with a hose may not do it. Is this a water and vinegar thing? Is this a bleach thing? Well, like my shoes?
Yeah, for shoes, getting a good shoe brush and removing the soil does a lot of good. Check the lacing, scrub that. And if you know that you are in an area with, say, very active infestation, you might actually have to use soap and water. But most of the time, you're able to scrape off the soil from your shoes and pick off seeds. You've done the vast majority of the prevention.
I know I go from pond to pond because I'm a herpetologist. But I do drop my shoes in vinegar and water.
Yes, that will help. And then letting it dry really helps too. But you actually may have two sets of waders.
Right. Now, I was at a master naturalist garden the other day, and I saw, incredible, beautiful flowers and plants and whatnot, many of which I know are not native. Is that okay in a garden to have non-native plants that are gorgeous? What's the danger you run of introducing a plant to our environment that's not native or that could be even invasive?
Right. Well, most of the plants that we bring in through horticulture don't become invasive. And so
they're just not strong enough or power, or they don't have the superpowers of multiplying aggressively.
But there is that small fraction that does. And so we just have to, before you actually buy a plant, you might consider, there's a brochure that you can Google it. It's called Garden Smart Oregon. Garden Smart Oregon, and it shows characteristics of horticulture plants that people like, but it also shows a native alternative or a non-invasive alternative to some, like ivy, for example, right? That's an
English ivy.
Yeah. So, or holly, for example, you know, there are certain plants that actually produce those fruits and berries and have those green leaves. And so check before you buy, check before you plant would be a good way when it comes to horticulture, for example.
And of course, when you plant native, you know, everybody should know this by now, but one problem with these blackberries, these non-native, is they're such water hogs that they just take a ton of water more than and away from our natives. And so when you do plant native, you know, your water bill will go down.
That's correct.
So yeah. Even for the home individual homeowner, there's some economic benefits right there.
Yeah, because availability of water, you know, when you want it, where you want it, it's going to be, you know, we're very lucky that we can turn on the tap or run the pump.
Right.
In some places, that's going to be more and more difficult.
Can you think of any benefits of invasive species, either flora or fauna, like where they've helped us solve a problem? Like I know people have tried in the past to bring in invasives to take care of a current problem. Do you have an example of some place where that has actually worked and the new guy that you brought in hasn't then added to your problems?
If the new organism we brought in hasn't added to a problem, it probably wasn't invasive. So,
okay.
All right. So, but I very frankly, I do not know of any cases where I would recommend planting an invasive organism, mainly because once we plant it, we probably won't be able to get rid of it.
So in the end, it took us a while to figure that out.
Yes.
And I know a lot of countries have brought in animals to take care of other problems, and it just kind of backfired.
Right. Now, there is something called biological control, which is you bring in a organism that is a natural predator of, say, an invasive plant or an invasive insect. And it takes many, many years of testing because you want to make sure that it's very specific to that host or that invasive organism, and that it doesn't actually end up attacking non-host plants or native plants or organisms. So that's a form of biological control. The thing with biological control is that it's also an artifact of nature in that biological control is not used to eradicate invasive species, but to manage it into populations that have minimal economic harm, because organisms will never eat themselves out of house and home. I mean,
right.
In this case, the biological control, there's always going to be some remnants left.
If an indigenous species or a native species disappears, is it okay if a non-native or an even invasive species takes up that niche in the environment?
I think we need to, that's a good question. Where we want to look at is what resulted in that native or indigenous species to disappear. Because if that species has disappeared, that tells us there's something else that is going on. Is it a land use? Is it a certain environmental factor? What's going on there? For example, in Southwest Oregon, the tan oak, which is being impacted by sudden oak death syndrome. If that disappeared, that's because it was caused by this non-native, you know, this invasive disease, right? And so the loss of that organism is not a good thing, because it indicates that something happened to it and there's a change we need to take care of, because what would end up replacing that tan oak species?
Right. So we better figure out what happened before.
Yeah. If you think about introducing another plant in there.
Yeah. And then I suppose if we wait, a native species will take over that niche. We don't have to fill it.
If we have a, if we promote the biodiversity or health of our native ecosystems, some of our native species will fill that niche.
So have you found the concept and the consideration and attitude of about invasive species has changed? Are you seeing more people being aware of it?
One of the coolest things about learning about human behavior towards invasive species is that when people learn about the impacts of invasive species, people are almost, they unify towards that it's probably not something that we want. And we also found out through our studies, you know, social science studies, that invasive species is apolitical. Doesn't matter what political party or your values that you have towards people in society, it's one of those that is apolitical. And so, and because of that, I actually have some hope that we can actually address invasive species problems, because people care about their environment. They care about what their community looks like. They care about human health. And especially here in Oregon, we care about our environment. And the good thing about Oregon is about 60% of our landscape is not invaded by invasive species.
60%, really?
Yeah, almost 60%. And that's, I think we're very lucky. And that's not true for a lot of places in our country. In Oregon, it
Not at,
is. And so
yeah,
we
not at
have a
all.
lot that we can protect, that we have a strong base to work with, because if you have a strong native ecosystem base to work with, you got the diversity, but and they're relatively healthy, we have a more resilient system. But we got to keep it that way. If we keep on introducing invasive species and we don't manage well and save our forests, or more their health weakens and they're more subject to catastrophic fires, then that's not going to help.
Oregon is fantastic, and we still have so many wildlands compared to the rest of the United States, but I feel like there's some hope.
Yeah, but also it means that we have this duty to be good stewards.
So I was going to say, is our ecosystem more or less fragile than other ecosystems in the United States? One hand it might be stronger, but
I think our system, mainly because of increasing population growth and our more uncertain climate due to very intense droughts, very intense floodings, cold periods, hot periods, our systems are stressed. But to reduce that stress, we need to be able to minimize the introduction and spread of invasive species. That's just another impacting variable that would actually decrease the ability of our systems to adjust to all these changes. And so, because people are a source of moving around invasive species, we have a, it's one area that we can change. We may not be able to change the climate that quickly or that fast, but we can change just simple behaviors like not moving around boats that we haven't cleaned, not planting plants that we know that are invasive, cleaning our gear. I think all those are important. And being citizen scientists, being lookout for invasive species and report them. You see a species that looks like that it's invasive, contact the Oregon Invasive Species Hotline. It's is OregonInvasiveSpecies.org. Yeah, or 1-800-INVADERS is our
Oh, that's a good one. That's
yeah,
a good one.
1-800-INVADERS. And there are people who you report it. We usually respond typically within 24 hours. Yeah, so you can do it online through the Oregon Invasive Species website or call 1-800-INVADERS.
So, are there any emerging technologies, any brand new technologies that are showing great promise for this battle of invasive species?
Think we're doing a better and better job in terms of finding good biological control agents for our species. In terms of technology, some of them are actually low tech, is understanding people's behavior. What is it that encourages people to spread an invasive species? And then, work with understanding what is it that can actually help people in not spreading that invasive species. So some of it is low tech, but it's really understanding people. Obviously, there are more and more chemicals, but like most people, we recognize that chemicals are one part of the equation in controlling invasive species, and they're a necessary part, but we don't want to constantly have to rely on chemicals everywhere. Also, invasive species can adapt to chemicals that they might develop, we might select for
Right.
resistance, and so therefore we constantly have to use different chemicals. But a lot of it's actually is with prevention. There's a lot more effort into surveillance now, and we use more and more drone surveillance now to look for patches of invasive species that are hard to access. And the key is to be able to find those small patches and then control them when they're small before they actually become large. Cleaning, hygiene, as well as the technology for surveillance, and then good biological control, more biological control, as well as using chemicals wisely are all part of that.
So it sounds like you really do need the participation of individuals. This is
Yeah.
not a government problem or a nonprofit or a problem or a conservation group problem. Individuals seem to be your best army on the
Yeah.
ground.
And then if you actually do have to land, plant species that are more native in your environments, because just like in a pollinator garden, the more diverse your plantings are, the more they attract beneficial insects and bees, pollinators, and that would also help.
Dr. Chan, thank you so much. This has been a wonderful eye-opener for me and such wonderful information. Thank you so much for the work you're doing.
It'd be a pleasure. And right now, the Oregon Invasive Species Council is actually planning to develop a series of regional field trips to work with people who are interested in this topic. And we're planning to develop that starting next year. And maybe your region can actually host one of these regional field trips with us.
We'd love to. We'd love to. That'd be fantastic.
Okay, great.
Thank you so much for your time.
Bye.
Alrighty, bye.